Pharaoh passed down the armory to inspect the huge array of weapons and armor already in store. Some of these had belonged to his forefathers and had been employed in famous battles. Others were newly manufactured and would never be used in war. All of them were magnificent, each a pinnacle of the armorer's art. There were helmets and breastplates of bronze and silver and gold, battle swords with ivory hilts set with precious stones, full-dress ceremonial uniforms of the commander-in-chief of each of the king's elite regiments, shields and bucklers in hippo hide and crocodile skin, all starred with rosettes of gold. It made a splendid array. From the armory we crossed the atrium to the furniture store, where 100 cabinet-makers laboured with cedar and acacia and precious ebony wood to build the funeral furnishings for the king's long journey. Very few substantial trees grow in our riparian valley, and wood is a scarce and costly commodity worth very nearly its weight in silver. Almost every stick of it must be carried hundreds of leagues across the desert, or shipped downstream from those mysterious lands to the south. Here it was piled in extravagant stacks, as though it were commonplace, and the fragrance of fresh sawdust perfumed the hot air. We watched while craftsmen inlaid the headboard of Pharaoh's bed with patterns of mother-of-pearl and woods of contrasting colour. Others decorated the armrests of the chairs with golden falcons and the backrests of the padded sofas with the heads of silver lions. Not even the halls of the royal palace at Elephantine Island contained such delicate workmanship as would grace the rock cell of the king's tomb. From the furniture treasury we passed on to the hall of the sculptors. In marble and sandstone and granite of 100 differing hues, the sculptors whittled and chipped away with chisel and file so that a fine pale dust hung in the air. The masons covered their noses and mouths with strips of linen on which the dust settled, and their features were powdered white with the insidious stuff. Some of the men coughed behind their masks as they worked, a persistent dry cough that was peculiar to their profession. I had dissected the corpses of many old sculptors who had worked 30 years and died at their trade. I found their lungs petrified and turned to stone in their bodies. Thus I spent as little time as possible in the mason's shop, lest I contract the same malady. Nonetheless, their products were wondrous to contemplate, statues of the gods and of Pharaoh himself that seemed to vibrate with life. There were life-sized images of Pharaoh seated on his throne or walking abroad, alive and dead, in his god form or in the shape of a mortal man. These statues would line the long causeway that led from the funerary temple on the valley floor up to the wall of black hills from which his final tomb was even at this moment being excavated. At his death, the golden hearse, drawn by a train of 100 white bullocks, was to bear his massive sarcophagus along that causeway to its final resting place. This granite sarcophagus, only partially completed, lay in the centre of the mason's hall. Originally it had been a single block of pink granite, quarried from the mines at Aswan, and ferried downriver in a barge especially constructed for that purpose. It had taken 500 slaves to haul it ashore and drag it over wooden rollers to where it now lay. An oblong of solid stone, 5 paces long, 3 wide and 3 tall. The masons had begun by sawing a thick slab from the top of it. Upon this granite lid a master mason was fashioning the likeness of the mummiform pharaoh, with his arms crossed and the crook and flail gripped in his dead hands. Another team of masons was now engaged in hollowing out the interior of the main granite block to provide a nest into which the cluster of inner coffins would fit perfectly, including the huge outer sarcophagus. There would be 7 coffins in all, fitting one within the other like a child's puzzle toy. 7 was, of course, one of the magical numbers. The innermost coffin would be of pure gold, and later we watched it being beaten out of the formless mass of metal in the hall of the goldsmiths. It was this multiple sarcophagus, this mountain of stone and gold, housing the king's wrapped corpse, that the great golden hearse would carry along the causeway to the hills, a slow journey that would take 7 whole days to complete. The hearse would stop each night in one of the small shrines that were spaced at intervals along the causeway. A fascinating adjunct to the Hall of Statues was the Ushabti shop at the rear, where the servants and retainers who would escort the dead king were being carved. These were perfect little mannequins of wood, representing all the grades and orders of Egyptian society who would work for the king in the hereafter, so as to enable him to maintain his estate and the style of his existence in the underworld. Each Ushabti was a delightfully carved wooden doll, dressed in the authentic uniform of his calling and bearing the appropriate tools. There were farmers and gardeners, fishermen and bakers, beer brewers and handmaidens, soldiers and tax collectors, scribes and barbers, and hundreds upon hundreds of common labourers to perform every menial task and to go forward in the king's place if ever he were called upon by the other gods to work in the underworld. At the head of this congregation of little figures, there was even a grand vizier, whose miniature features closely resembled those of my lord Intef. Pharaoh picked out this mannequin and examined him closely, turning him over to read the description on his back. "My name is Lord Intef, Grand Vizier of the Upper Kingdom, Pharaoh's sole companion, three times the recipient of the gold of praise. I am ready to answer for the king." Pharaoh passed the doll to my lord Intef. "Is your physique truly so muscular, my lord Intef?" he asked with a smile just below the surface of his dour expression. And the Grand Vizier bowed slightly. "The sculptor has failed to do me justice, Your Majesty." The last treasury that the king visited that day was the Hall of the Goldsmiths. The infernal glow of the furnaces cast a strange glow on the features of the jewellers, as they worked with total concentration at their benches. I had coached them well. At the entrance of the royal entourage, the goldsmiths knelt in unison to make the triple obeisance to Pharaoh, and then rose and resumed their work. Even in that large hall, the heat of the furnace flames was so sulphurous as almost to stop the breath, and we were soon bathed in our own sweat. However, the king was so fascinated by the treasure displayed for him that he seemed not to notice the oppressive atmosphere. He went directly to the raised dais in the centre of the hall, where the most experienced and skilful smiths were at work upon the golden inner coffin. They had perfectly captured Pharaoh's living face in the shimmering metal. The mask would fit exactly over his bandaged head. It was a divine image, with eyes of obsidian and rock crystal, and with the cobra-headed uraeus encircling the brow. I truly believe that no finer masterpiece of the goldsmith's art has ever been fashioned in all the 1,000 years of our civilization. This was the peak and the zenith. All the unborn ages might one day marvel at its splendour. Even after Pharaoh had admired the golden mask from every angle, he seemed unable to tear himself too far from it. He spent the remainder of the day on the dais beside it, seated on a low stool, while box after cedarwood box of exquisite jewels were laid at his feet and the contents catalogued for him. I cannot believe that such a treasure was ever before accumulated in one place at one time. To make a bald list of the items does not in the least way suggest the richness and diversity of it all. Nonetheless, let me tell you at the outset that there were 6,455 pieces already in the cedarwood boxes, and that each day more were added to the collection as the jewellers worked on tirelessly. There were rings for Pharaoh's toes as well as his fingers. There were amulets and charms and gold figurines of the gods and goddesses. There were necklaces and bracelets and pectoral medallions and belts on which were inlaid falcons and vultures, and all the other creatures of the earth and the sky and the river. There were crowns and diadems studded with lapis lazuli, and garnets and agate, and carnelians and jasper, and every gemstone that civilized man holds dear. The artistry with which all this had been designed and manufactured eclipsed all that had been created over the preceding 1,000 years. It is often in decline that a nation creates its most beautiful works of art. In the formative years of empire, the obsession is with conquest and the building up of wealth. It is only once this has been achieved that there is leisure and a desire to develop the arts, and, more importantly, rich and powerful men to sponsor them. The weight of gold and silver already used in the manufacture of the hearse and the funeral mask, and all the rest of this breathtaking collection of treasure, was in excess of 500 tucks. Thus it would have taken 500 strong men to lift it all. I had calculated that this was almost 1/10 of the total weight of these precious metals that had been mined in the entire 1,000 years of our recorded history. All of this the king intended taking with him to the tomb. Who am I, a humble slave, to question the price that a king was willing to pay for eternal life? Suffice it only to state that in assembling this treasure, while at the same time conducting the war against the lower kingdom, Pharaoh had, almost alone and unaided, plunged this very Egypt of ours into beggary. No wonder, then, that Thanos in his declamation had singled out the depredation of the tax collectors as one of the most terrible afflictions visited upon the populace. Between them and the robber bands that ravaged unchecked and unhindered through the countryside, we were all ruined and crushed under the financial yoke that was too heavy for any of us to bear. To survive at all, we had to evade the tax collector's net. So as he set out to beggar us for his own aggrandizement, the king made criminals of us at the same moment. Very few of us, great or small, rich or poor, slept well at night. We lay awake dreading at any moment the heavy knock of the tax collector upon the door. O sad and abused land, how it groaned beneath the yoke! Lavish quarters had been prepared in the necropolis in which the king would spend that night upon the west bank of the Nile, close to his own final resting place in the gaunt black hills. The necropolis, the city of the dead, was almost as extensive as Karnak itself. It was home to all those associated with the building and the care of the funerary temple and the royal tomb. There was a full regiment of the elite guard to protect the holy places, for the usurper in the north was as avaricious for treasure as was our own dear king, while the robber barons in the desert became each day bolder and more daring. The treasuries of the funerary temple were a sore temptation to every predator in the two kingdoms and beyond. In addition to the guards, there were the companies of the craftsmen and the artisans and all their apprentices to house. I was responsible for the records of wages and rations, so I knew exactly how many there were. On the last payday, their number had been 4,811. Added to this, there were over 10,000 slaves employed upon the work. I will not weary myself by listing the numbers of oxen and sheep that had to be slaughtered each day to feed them all, nor the cartloads of fish that were brought up from the Nile, nor the thousands of jars of beer that were brewed daily to slake the summer thirst of this multitude as they laboured under the watchful eye and the ready lash of the overseers. The necropolis was a city, and in that city was a palace for the king. It was with relief that we moved into it to spend the night, for it had been a wearying day. But once again there was little rest for me. I tried to reach my Lady Lostris, but it was almost as if there existed a conspiracy to keep me away from her. According to her little black maids, first she was at toilet, and after that she was in her bath, and then she was resting and could not be disturbed. Finally, as I still waited in the antechamber of her quarters, a summons reached me from her father, and I could linger no longer, but must hurry to my master. As soon as I entered my Lord Intef's bedchamber, he dismissed all the others in the room. When we were alone, he kissed me. I was once more surprised by his benevolence and disturbed by his excited manner. Seldom had I seen him in such mood, and always before it had adumbrated calamitous events. "How often the gateway to power and fortune is found in the most unexpected place," he laughed at me, and caressed my face. "This time it lies between the thighs of a woman. No, my own darling, don't play the innocent. I know just what a cunning hand you've taken in all of this. Pharaoh's told me how you cajoled him into it by promising him a male heir to his line. By Seth, but you are the cunning one, are you not? Not a word to me of your design, but you schemed it all on your own account." He laughed again, and twisted a lock of my hair between his fingers. "You must have divined my ultimate ambition all along, even though we have never discussed it openly. So you set out to achieve it for me. Of course I should have you punished for your presumption." He twisted the lock of hair until tears started into my eyes. "But how can I be angry with you when you have placed the double crown within my grasp?" He released the tress of my hair and kissed me again. "I have just come from the king's presence. In 2 days, at the culmination of the festival, he will announce his betrothal to my daughter Lostris." I felt a sudden darkness behind my eyes, and a chilly dew formed on my skin. "The wedding will take place the same day, immediately after the closing ceremony of the festival. I saw to that. We don't want any delay in which something might happen to prevent it, do we?" Such a swift royal wedding was unusual, but not unheard of. When brides were chosen to seal a political union or to consolidate the conquest of a new territory, the wedding often took place the very same day it was decided. Pharaoh Mamoza I, forefather of our present pharaoh, had married the daughter of a conquered Hurrian chieftain on the actual battlefield. However, such historical precedents were of little comfort to me now as I faced the bleak maturation of my worst fears.